Well, I think I'll start out with the introduction. This particular part of our celebration is to honor the career and life of Professor Lawrence Mizak. And to do that today, we have a very distinguished guest by the name of Gordon Swatters, currently a professor in the Department of Mathematical and Statistical Sciences at the University of Alberta. Professor Swatters received the Honors Bachelor's of Math in Applied Mathematics from the University of Waterloo in 1978, subsequently received the PhD in Applied Mathematics and Physical Oceanography from the University of British Columbia in 1985 under the supervision of Professor Mizak. Dr. Swatters completed postdoctoral studies in the Department of Earth, Atmospheric, and Planetary Sciences at my alma mater, MIT, under the supervision of Professor Glenn Fleurel. Dr. Swatters' research, which is an interdisciplinary blend of applied mathematics, physical oceanography, and computational science, is focused on understanding the planetary scale dynamics of ocean currents, a key component in Earth's evolving climate. Gordon has published 86 refereed research papers, given over 61 invited lectures in 14 countries, and has successfully supervised 17 master's and PhD students. Since joining the University of Alberta in 1986, Gordon has held concurrent visiting positions at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, the Isaac Newton Institute for the Mathematical Sciences in Cambridge, and the French Institute for the Research and Exploration of the Sea in Brest, France. So we're pleased to welcome today Dr. Swatters.
The audiovisual guy tells me I'm not allowed to use this, but I feel almost naked giving a talk without my laser pointer, so if I turn my head, I do apologize. I'm a bit of an anomaly, obviously. I think everybody else is directly connected with McGill, and I represent, in many ways, Lawrence's last days at UBC. I'm the third last PhD student he had at UBC, and indeed, I'm the last analytician, the last unrepentant theoretician that he supervised. Thereafter, majority of his students went heavily computational and were involved in climate dynamics. So I'm the last of the mesoscale theoreticians that Lawrence supervised, we'll say. When I say idiosyncratic retrospective, I mean that just simply by the fact that I actually had to do a fair amount of reading to fully understand what Lawrence has been doing over the last decade and a half. Even though every time we get together we have a jolly good time, much of the work in the last decade hasn't been exactly what I'm involved with, so it's a bit divergent. So this was a good learning exercise for me again, Lawrence. Thank you, as my teacher, and I do appreciate it. We UBC students, then, used to refer to ourselves as the members of the Mizak Mafia out there, and that's... We all share it quite proudly. We are all grateful and we're all inspired by Lawrence. And as I said, we called ourselves members of the Mizak Mafia. Even though he has a Ukrainian background, we went that route. Let me try to give some groundwork here. I am going to give a very high level, and I don't mean that in an arrogant sense. I mean that there will be zero equations here, even though I do spend my life with PDEs all the time. But... it's important to set the background. I do have a few slides related to Lawrence's early life and career. So if the experience of our upbringing is the nutrient from which all else blossoms, here's a direct quote from Lawrence. I come from a very conservative background. Generations of farmers and peasants. People growing up in the Depression on the Canadian prairies, they were worried about what you're going to do for a living. Certainly, mathematics didn't seem very practical. And it's kind of interesting, him being a conservative, because although I regret this part of my life, when I went to UBC, I sort of proclaimed myself as a proud radical Marxist in those days. And so you'd think that a person which has conservative views and somebody such as myself, you'd be at loggerheads all the time. Well, this is a tribute to Lawrence, of course, that he's a very, very generous man. And even though I was wrong then... We never ever had any arguments of that sort. It was a wonderful supervisor on the research side of things. So where did it all begin? Well, Lawrence was born in 1940 in Saskatoon to his parents, obviously, Stephen and Anastasia Mysak. And there's a picture up here, this picture of, there's Lawrence here at 1 year old, and this is his sister Helen, father and mother. And then they moved to Edmonton in 1946, where I don't think it was the first house, but eventually settling in Belgravia, which is a middle-class neighborhood adjacent to the University of Alberta. This is a picture, by the way, of Lawrence in 1948. Now, I can say this because I do love the man. Wasn't he a cutie? I mean, really, hey? Here he is, right? 8 years old. What a cutie. Lawrence's family house in Belgravia no longer exists. However, I did take a shot off MLS Realty for a typical house in Belgravia. It's about two blocks from where Lawrence grew up. This house, to give you an idea of how life changes, this house is listed for about $610,000 in Edmonton right now. However, the Mysak house was torn down, and it now would sit underneath. I'm sure there's sweat there somehow underneath that ground. But the Mysak house was torn down to build this LRT station, which is our light rail transit system in Edmonton. So it's about three blocks from the University of Alberta. This is a picture of two pictures at the top, both 1955. So Lawrence would have been 15 years old, just prior, I guess, just entering high school. The right picture is a picture of Lawrence in Niagara Falls, Ontario. And I think he must have been a Boy Scout in that picture. Of some sort. But you already begin to see, you know, that lovely smile, that grin, that, you know, clearly a very, very happy childhood, it seems to me. And there he is, but I think the Boy Scout picture, that's certainly, I can start to see inklings of the supervisor I knew in the mid-80s, standing there very nonchalantly and just very self-composed. The lower picture in this particular slide is of Corbett Hall. It's one of the older buildings at U of A. Of course, anything older than about 5 years old we call old in Alberta, but whatever. It's one of the older buildings in U of A, and that's actually, as I understand it, now I might have this wrong, this is where Lawrence actually went to high school. So it's now actually just used for administrative offices, but it would have been about two blocks from where he grew up. Now, how did Lawrence enter our discipline, we'll say, as atmospheric ocean dynamics? Well, it didn't start that way. Lawrence actually started off as a cosmologist. I don't know how many of you know that. What happened is in 1961, he took a course in tensor analysis from the renowned cosmologist, now retired, lives in Victoria, Werner Israel. And out of that experience of taking that tensor course, he actually went to Australia, where he did graduate work, got an MSc in Australia, for work in black hole dynamics. And below in the sort of this color here is an exact quote from Werner, an email I received. And I should point out to you, there's a book, actually, 300 Years of Gravitation, cited below, which he describes as paper. Now, it's nice to know even the great ones, here I refer to Lawrence, have trouble publishing their first damn paper. It's certainly an experience I had. This paper took 3 years to get accepted, which eventually published in the Canadian Journal of Physics. And what the paper was, as Werner says, this paper provided an important link en route to the no-hair theorems for black holes. And although I've never really understood what that is, Werner does describe it quite well, that black holes are entirely symmetrical, have no topographic, here I use jargon we're comfy with, no topographic irregularities of any sort. And Werner credits this work with this paper that Lawrence wrote with an important step on the journey to proving what Werner is very famous for, the no-hairs theorem in black hole dynamics. So Lawrence started off as a cosmologist and then subsequently, as I go on to the next slide, went into GFD, if you will, physical oceanography. And I have talked to Lawrence about why this is. And he describes in the summer times as a student, he worked with the Canadian version of DARPA, the Defense Research Labs, and he fell in love with waves. And of course, ocean waves. And in black hole dynamics, there aren't a lot of waves that we, well, I don't even think anybody has detected waves, gravitational waves yet. So certainly not in the early 60s, the result of which was that Lorentz, who loved wave motions, migrated into a field in which there was an abundance of these wave motions. Now, Lorentz's academic pedigree is impeccable. And, of course, it's also my academic pedigree, which is why it's worthy of presenting here, I guess. Lorentz, anyways, subsequently entered the graduate program at Harvard in applied math / geophysical fluid dynamics and earned his PhD for work in coastally trapped waves. I have a couple of remarks to say. But as you can see, the history here, it goes all the way back. Lorentz was a student of Alan Robinson, who just passed away earlier this year, professor of oceanography at Harvard. And Alan was himself a product of one of the greatest applied mathematicians of the 20th century, George Carrier, who actually, and this is actually my work trying to figure this out because it was hard to dig out, nobody seemed to knew whatever, who did George Carrier work with? Well, George Carrier actually worked with a fellow named Norman Goodyear. And Norman actually, for a time, Norman actually was a research scientist at the Ontario Research Labs just prior to World War II, where he went to Cornell and then Stanford. But, you know, all good things ultimately do cycle back, and we cycle back to the Ukraine, because Norman Goodyear was a student of one of the greatest mechanicians of the 20th century, Stefan Timoshenko, who was both a member of the Russian Academy of Sciences, fellow of the Royal Society, and National Academy of Sciences. And then we see, ultimately, we get back to fluids, although not in this lineage here, with Ludwig Prandtl. And then August Foppel, who is, by the way, Einstein actually explicitly credits for being influential in his work in special relativity for August's writing a book on Maxwell's theory of electricity, actually, electromagnetism. And then August was a student of the very well-known elastician, Otto Moore, civil engineer, actually. But then our lineage, will say, stops there because Otto did not have a PhD. Okay? So that's the end. Anyways, excellence begets excellence, and we can see very well that the tradition of excellence resides very comfortably with Lorentz. So let me try to have a few slides here. I have tried to be balanced here between UBC and McGill in my slides here. Contributions while at the University of British Columbia, well, primarily, of course, in the very early years, they were derived from his work as a PhD student. And as I say here, while there are many similarities between synoptic scale atmospheric and oceanographic dynamics, one thing that the ocean has that the atmosphere doesn't have is horizontal boundaries, namely the continental boundaries, together with rather sharply varying bottom topography. And these lead to a unique class of geophysical wave motions known as coastally trapped waves, and in particular continental shelf waves specifically. Now, from the viewpoint of the theoretician, if you will, from the modeling exercise, the central challenge revolves around the fact that the horizontal and vertical modes associated with the waves can't be separated. Now, Lorentz's very early career was principally focused on these sorts of waves, and indeed, there were up until there was a great period in the 60s and 70s when this was a central point of wave research in oceanography. Prior to Lorentz's work and others, there was very few known solutions. By that I mean exact solutions for coastally trapped waves. In fact, you have to go back to basically Stokes, and then you have to jump forward almost 100 years to work by Eckhart, Ursel, and then his own supervisor, Robinson, in 1964 to find further theoretical work on these strongly topographically forced wave motions. What was Lorentz's principal contributions here? And again, I'll apologize in advance to my former supervisor. I've been unable to delineate the vast array of results that he's obtained. So if I get some of them wrong, I apologize. If I miss some of them, of course, I'll take full responsibility as well. Out of his PhD work, Lorentz actually showed the discrepancy between the observed and theoretical phase speeds of Australian continental shelf waves, that's CSWs, was explained by the ambient deep sea stratification, 1967. In fact, I would say this business of wanting to understand the anomalies in the observed phase speeds of waves in the ocean is still, even today, current research. Still, satellite observations of Rossby wave propagation do not seem to agree with the dispersion relationship. There's still papers written today on trying to resolve this quandary. Together with a co-author, Hammond, in 1969, Lorentz provided the first observational evidence for the existence of continental shelf wave propagation along the east coast of North America. So even here, we begin to see, as I believe the best applied mathematics has done, pulling in phenomenologically oriented work. Lorentz made notable other contributions to continental shelf wave theory, introduction of nonlinearity into the theory, interaction with mean flows, alongshore topographic irregularities, and equatorial dynamics. Indeed, Lorentz's work was the principal theoretical motivation for the 1980s oceanographic experiment, ACE, which was the Australian Coastal Experiment, which was a major observational and theoretical study of shelf waves in those waters. In this early part of Lorentz's career, he still was an applied mathematician. He resided within a math department at UBC as a professor and still wrote papers that had a heavily mathematical bent in the classical applied math sense. And indeed, Lorentz introduced in the 70s innovative mathematical operator theory methods to model the propagation of ocean waves along random varying boundaries. The culmination, I would argue, personal point of view, was the work with William Shea of this continental shelf wave work, which was the first rational theory in 1980 of energy exchange between continental shelf waves, resonantly interacting continental shelf waves. And moreover, beyond developing the theory, he, together with his PhD student, William Shea, showed observationally that this process was in fact occurring off the coast of Oregon. In many ways, I consider William's work to be the best wave thesis ever produced at UBC. And I do argue it's the end of his principal contributions in classical continental shelf research. So you can see 1980 and the beginning of the transition. Lorentz in the 60s and 70s, as I say here, again, based on observation, it was becoming abundantly clear. See, the meteorologists are, 20 years ahead of the oceanographers in many of these sorts of exercises? But during the 60s and 70s, it became abundantly clear that motion in the ocean was not quasi-steady. You don't think of steady currents. But was more appropriately described as turbulent cauldron of eddies, swirls, whirls, and other growing and decaying wave-like motions. But what was the energy source? And what was the dynamical mechanism for these transients? Lorentz made numerous significant contributions to oceanographically relevant, most particularly barotropic instability theory and geophysical wave systems in random varying meetings in a variety of contexts. This all, we all think about this is obvious now. It wasn't obvious then. What was the mechanism for the destabilization? Together with Kneeler, in fact, in 1971, Lorentz was the first to show that the Gulf Stream off Cape Hatteras was barotropically unstable with respect to continental shelf wave perturbations, and thus provided one out of perhaps more than one mechanism for the development of Gulf Stream meanders. In 1977, was Lorentz, together with Fritz Schott, was the first to show that the observed current fluctuations in the Norwegian current were due to baroclinic instability. The Norwegian current being the extension of the North Atlantic current, which is itself the mid-ocean extension of the Gulf Stream. Analyses of these kind were applied to innumerable currents. And indeed, as was once said to me after I graduated under Lorentz's supervision, a very well-known, and I'll say American, GFDer, was once heard to remark, "Larry hasn't left any damn current for anybody else to study." So, other wave contributions. Well, Lorentz introduced innovative kinetic theory methods to model the energy transport by internal gravity waves in a randomly stratified ocean. He developed the theory with others for the scattering properties of low-frequency ocean waves that were reflecting off continental islands. And what I believe is the hallmark of the transition to a climate scientist was the first to propose in 1981 that annual period Rossby waves in the Central Pacific were generated by seasonal oscillations of the east boundary current off BC Washington. And with Lawrence Maggard, then at Hawaii, Rossby wave rectification along the Hawaiian Ridge creates a previously unobserved mean flow, which was subsequently confirmed by direct observations. And, of course, all of us in the world of ocean waves have, as a Bible on our bookshelf, the massive encyclopedic treatise, Waves in the Ocean, that he co-authored with Paul LeBlanc in 1978. I have one of these in my study and one in my office. I just hand it to my students. They start here. 1980s and the transition to climate wizard. Well, actually, as I arrived at UBC, I mean, we've always had this interesting relationship. The minute I showed up at UBC, Lawrence said, well, guess what? I'm going away for a year. And he and Mary went to ETH in Zurich. And the top picture there is a picture of him. In those days, actually, people, I guess profs in physical sciences still use blackboards. Nobody uses a blackboard anymore. But at any rate, this is a picture of Lawrence working out the theory in ETH, you can see the German at the top, on topographic waves in elliptical basins. And we can see the aspect ratio much less than one. There's my only equation of the talk. Okay, so he took that. But it was basically the last of the wave papers that Lawrence wrote. And as he himself says, in 82-83, there was an El Nino year, and many of you will know that that El Nino year was the largest such event in the century. And Lawrence became fascinated by this event. The picture below, with him with the wizard hat, is not me doing funny things in Photoshop. This is, in fact, actually a picture which was well circulated at UBC just prior to him coming here, in which it was seen that who was this hard-nosed theoretician, applied math type, working in wave dynamics and moving into climate dynamics, and lots of us that were of the wave school sort of went, it's all smoke and mirrors. It's not really got equations in it. And so this was done by Keith Thompson, by the way, Lawrence, a cartoon. And in fact, the salmon picture there, Lawrence will appreciate, was the salmon picture associated with MOIST, which I described. So, anyways, moving on. Together with Parsons and Shea in 1982, Lawrence showed that interannual, and as I say, the transition to climate scientist, interannual variability observed in fish populations in the Northeast Pacific Ocean was highly correlated with variations in sea surface temperature, salinity, and sea level. And so Lawrence wanted to understand this connection, and in an effort to understand the dynamics of this interannual variability and its role in the fisheries, Lawrence, together with Kevin Hamilton, who subsequently came to McGill and then went to the States and is now sunning himself in Hawaii on a permanent basis, and biologist Groot, and about 15 graduate students in PDFs, formed this four-year interdisciplinary study, MOIST, as we called it at UBC, Meteorological and Oceanographic Influence in Sockeye Tracts. And this work culminated in the development of the first numerical forecast model for fish migration in the Northeast Pacific Ocean. And it was this transition to interannual variability, which was the transition to climate scientist. So contributions made while at McGill University in 1986 to present, and if I get some of this wrong, I do apologize. But from 1986 onward, Lawrence's principal research has been on air-sea and air-ice-sea interactions in the North Atlantic and Arctic, and the role in determining natural climate variability on interannual, decade-to-century, and millennial timescales. Lawrence's research paradigm, however, throughout his entire career, paradigm I emphasize, hasn't changed. Lawrence's tries to explain complex physical interactions using simpler models. He's not a GCMer in that sense, more of a process person in that sense, and tries to elucidate the dynamics using process studies. I don't need to tell you that he's, I realize the name has changed over time, but I've just put in the most current name, was the founding director of GEC Cubed, and currently models your system modeling group within your department. Lawrence's work has been instrumental in understanding decadal scale variations in Arctic sea ice cover. He was the first to show, together with his students, in 1989, the existence of the significant decadal scale variations in Arctic sea ice cover. Associated with this work was the determination that a negative feedback mechanism linking freshwater discharge into the Arctic Ocean with salinity anomalies in the North Atlantic and sea ice results in a decadal climate cycle in the Arctic. And recent contributions have suggested that the variations in sea ice export from the Arctic plays a major role in NAO, North Atlantic oscillation, phase switching, and that the dominant signal in the Arctic is about an 8 to 13 year time signal characterized by clockwise rotation of anomalies in the sea ice cover. Lawrence's work on collinear formation was the conceptual framework for a major 4-year project in Baffin Bay, referred to as the North Water Project. Lawrence has made contributions to the meridional overturning circulation and centennial climate variability research areas. Just to summarize, European temperature records clearly show a century-scale oscillation alternating between relatively warm and cool periods. Lawrence and co-workers, here I've picked on Stocker and Huang and Schmidt, introduced simple 2D MOC meridional overturning circulation models showing the existence of stable internal century-scale oscillations capable of reproducing the variability seen in the temperature records. Again, similarly, Lawrence and his students in the mid-90s showed that fluctuations in summer rainfall in Siberia were dynamically linked to SST anomalies in the Northwest Atlantic Ocean. Further work Lawrence has made on modeling the dynamics of sea ice and sea ice-ocean interactions. Over the years, Lawrence's collaborators have been pioneers in the development of sea ice-ocean models and their use in climate process studies and climate variability. I have to say that before I joined Lawrence, I actually was I didn't have a graduate degree. I just had a little bachelor's degree. I worked in Newfoundland at Memorial University as a research assistant, I guess, in SeaCore. And SeaCore was a Center for Cold Ocean Resources Engineering, and I worked on sea ice problems there. And when Lawrence told me in the mid-90s that he was going to start working on sea ice, I tried to shake him silly, because sea ice is just is a whole other minefield. I mean, the rheology, nobody really knows what's going on. I tried to say, Lawrence, this is just far too difficult. But of course, my supervisor did not listen to me, and he started to work and has made notable contributions to sea ice. In 85, he coupled Hibbler's dynamic sea ice model to an isopycnal ocean model to study mixed layer circulation in the Arctic, and in 96 published the first coupled ice-ocean simulation to correctly reproduce the cyclonic subsurface circulation in that ocean basin. Working with Bruno in the mid-90s, Bruno, now a colleague in your department, developed the so-called Tremblay-Mysak sea ice model, TIM-SIM, as I call it, based on granular material rheology that was capable of simulating Arctic sea ice evolution and the seasonal ice edge evolution. And this model has been applied to a variety of scenarios, and in particular study the geographical distribution of tracers and drifts in the transpolar drift stream in the Arctic. And in just a few years ago, Lawrence and his students, again in the sea ice work, Sean Marshall at U Calgary, yay, Alberta, 3D coupled Sean Marshall's 3D ice sheet model to show that there are internal physics, that the internal physics of ice sheets are themselves capable of sustaining millennia-scale oscillations. I haven't really read that paper carefully, but that gets me excited. I'm going to have to look at that more carefully, which can lead to the formation of fast-moving ice streams and hence iceberg calving and so-called Heinrich events. Over the last few years, Lawrence has been instrumental in, well, Lawrence's group has been so-called development of the brown and green. Brown is my word. I know he calls it green, but I call it the brown and green McGill paleoclimate model. And as I say here, that this is a model of reduced, as I say in the very reduced complexity, which is itself, which is the creation of models of reduced complexity to reveal important dynamical processes in ocean ice climate dynamics. And I would say, from my reading of Lawrence's literature, this has been the major effort over the last several years. And this model, the McGill paleoclimate model, has been used to look at millennial scale climate fluctuations that have occurred in the last glacial period, glacial inceptions, which was the last talk I saw Lawrence give out in Alberta, and other millennial and scale oscillations which have occurred. When I say embarrassing, it's not because there's anything to be embarrassed about other than the fact that is there an award left that he hasn't won? I don't know. But they're all extremely well-deserved, and they are not all listed here, but I do want to give you a sense of just how honored, rightfully so, the man is. In the 1980s, you could see the beginning of it, the Fellow Royal Society of Canada, so on, getting this prestigious a professorship here. In the 1990s, becoming an order, a member of the Order of Canada, inaugural fellows in many, many, many societies, and so on. And in the 2000s, a number of awards, as well as I understand, in Quebec, you call it the Nobel Prizes. In Quebec, and I have just seen in the Gazette, McGill Gazette, there are more awards listed here, which unfortunately I have not listed here. I should have typed it in quickly. I did not. But we are physical scientists, and often we do like to summarize, although I think unfairly, the worth of a person by the numbers that they produced, and so I have listed that here. Over 180 refereed publications, over $6 million in peer-reviewed support. Boy, I thought I was doing good with 60 invited lectures. Look at this, right? 360 invited seminars in 25 countries, 29 provincial, national, international awards and honors, over 90 graduate students and postdocs, research associates and sabbatical visitors, and his graduate students have gone on to win 22 major research prizes and awards. And in many ways, I don't want to detract from Lawrence's academic accomplishments, but I think that all of us would recognize that perhaps in many ways our genuine legacy we could possibly leave behind is the legacy of our students. And in that way, Lawrence is surpassed by none. In 2009, Lawrence was awarded the Distinguished Alumni Award, the highest honor that the University of Alberta can bestow on an alumnus. Picture there is a picture of Lawrence getting it from our president, and I have tried to embed, hopefully it works, the video which was created for that, and if all goes well, it should work now.
And his boundless energy, boundless enthusiasm. And he gives.
He is of the utmost intellectual integrity and honesty. He has very high standards. And for me, Lawrence is the model of what a scientist should be.
He's usually one of the quietest people at the table. He's not in there tooting his own horn like many people are in the fields of science or things related to them.
Well, I was born in Saskatoon in 1940. In 1946, we moved to Edmonton. The hockey practice and band practice were on the same night, so I had to make a choice. And my father wisely said, I doubt if you'll be playing hockey in your 30s, 40s, now in my 60s. And he was right. Starting university, I was really torn between music and dentistry. But in dentistry, you did a pre-year of pre-dentistry, and it was cutting apart little frogs that didn't appeal to me, and the blood squirting and so on. So dentistry was not for me, but I had a very good math professor. In fact, the chair of the department wrote to me and said, you know, you should enroll in honors math. So that was it. And the other thing was, I guess, the music. I loved the music. That was a very important part of my life there.
I'm sure that the same qualities that make a good musician of him probably are playing a role in his the brilliance and excellence as a scientist.
One of the most important things to understanding where we're going with climate is the interactions between the atmosphere and the ocean. And that's been his specialty for a long time.
In the 1980s, we spent a sabbatical in Switzerland, and that year there was a huge climatic event known as El Niño. It was the biggest El Niño event of the century. It actually affected the weather patterns in Europe and the Middle East. And I said, hey, this is interesting. I've got to learn more about this.
I think what he's doing is addressing both some important issues with predicting future climates, but also as the basis for predicting what the ecology of the ocean is going to do under changing climate.
And I think the biggest worry in which I hit people with is the global warming will affect sea level rise, not just the thermal expansion, but when you start melting the land ice sheets, Greenland, Antarctica, melting Greenland will raise the sea level 6 meters. So that's going to wipe out 40% of the global population. And then we'll have the problem of environmental refugees, never mind political refugees. Environmental refugees will be hundreds of millions of displaced people. Where are they going to go? And we get so frustrated with these climate skeptics who, you know, point to literature which is not refereed, it's not been critically reviewed before publication, and people who pull up data sets here and there which seem to counter global warming. So we get very frustrated by this sort of activity, but we do our best to educate continuously as much as we can.
Lawrence is a giver. So he's someone who, you know, probably life gave him a lot, but he's giving a lot back too. So there was a scholarship, a graduate scholarship, which is very prominent, that was endowed by Lawrence St. Mary in honor of Lawrence's parents. This is generosity on a very, very practical level. So he gives his time, he gives his money, he gives his energy for others.
Once you have achieved some measure of success, you realize, well, there's been a lot of people helping me along the way. So I think once I got established and I got my share of awards, well, everyone deserves, you know, a kick at the can, so to speak.
I'm delighted to see a natural scientist get recognized. What he's doing, I think, if you were to be able to evaluate a century-long bottom line, will be as important as any invention or economic discovery.
And that ends my tribute to my friend.
Well, we'll take some time for any further tributes from the audience.
Very well. He's a very good supervisor. Thank you, Lawrence.
I can add on the fact that when I first arrived at McGill, Lawrence is my neighbor, actually, on the seventh floor, one of the few faculty people from our department on the seventh floor. And we both have rather large offices, and I think he takes a much better care of his office than mine. It's at least the seventh floor office. And I just want to thank you, Lawrence, for all the guidance you've given me. You've been great to your students, but you've also been fabulous as a mentor for young faculty, and I really appreciate that. Okay, so with that, we'll move on now to last but not least, our next individual requires not one but two speakers. So I'd like to therefore introduce Professor Frederick Fabry, who is a colleague of mine in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Fred was actually a student of both Ishtar and Jeff Austin, I believe, and got his PhD in 1994. And since that time, he's been at Boulder at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, and arrived here as a young faculty member in the late 1990s. So Fred is, I believe, going to start out, and then followed by Dr. Raymond de Elia. After graduating from the University of Buenos Aires, Raymond came to McGill in 1994 to undertake a master's degree and further a PhD under the guidance of Ishtar. His work there was devoted to understanding the possibilities of wind retrieval from single Doppler and from bistatic Doppler radar data. After completing his degree in the year 2000, he was a postdoc at UQAM under Professor René Laprise on issues relating to predictability and limited area models. And since 2004, he's been with the Uranos Consortium, where he is actually now heading the climate analysis group. So with that, we welcome both Professor Fabry and Dr. de Elia. Thank you.
Well, we'll have to wait for that size then. Okay, so good afternoon, everyone. Raman and I have been tasked to give a tribute to Ishtar's career. Now, Ishtar is such a colorful and complex character, as these pictures can illustrate, that we needed to be two to do an honest job at it. And it will be a bit different in style than some of the other presentations that you've seen this afternoon. Raman will start with a bit of a timeline of Ishtar's careers, and I will continue talking a bit about Ishtar, the science, and the scientist.
Thank you, Fred. Well, Ishtar, I hope you agree with what I say. So Ishtar life starts in Poland in 1939, which is a very bad year to start your life, and so he had to really move around Europe for a while, and until finally he and his family were able to, he was a kid, he was able to live in a boat towards Argentina, towards the south. There, he started his life, he started having a normal life, he went to school. The legend says that he had a fight every day with school kids, and apparently he won many of them, and finally he made many good friends. He went to high school. He went to university. In the university, he decided to study physics, and he also was working at the same time. And he finally, and I think that's where the career starts, he graduates in physics.
All right.
Okay. He graduated in physics, I was saying, and these are the buildings that probably he was walking around that time. And the line on top is what, that's the reason he said why he started studying applied science, like hail prevention project, that is his first interesting thing he was doing in atmospheric physics. And the line explains why he was not doing more theoretical physics. And the line below, that was added many years later, probably some kind of irony of life about what he thought about how things were in reality. So this project, the hail prevention project, has a good had a good project that's similar in Canada, and for that reason, Ishtar decides to do the adventure and move to Canada.
I just realized what the problem is.
Okay.
Ah, yeah.
So he moves to Canada, and this is an interesting picture you're going to see now. This is Ishtar thinking about the future. He's just before arriving to Canada, he's in Philadelphia. And then he arrives to Canada finally. And he starts working under Marshall, and the title refers a bit about the pedagogical methods of Marshall. And the picture on the right is this is a picture in his master thesis, where he developed the Harpy radar display. You see it a bit. And while he's having fun doing this, something important happened. And not for him, but for Argentina. There is a coup d'etat, students are arrested, professors too, the departments are disbanded, and Ishtar somehow he was planning to return. So he decides not to return. And many friends of him said that the coup d'etat was a great thing for him. And he graduates with a master, and he starts working with Roddy Rogers in a PhD. On the left, we have him with growing beard and tasting. He looks like a Montrealer now, more like an Argentinian or a Polish. And on the right, you see the apparatus he was building. It's a correlator to correlate different precipitation patterns. And that time, with analogical images, was very complicated. And the analysis of this and the building of the apparatus was enough to earn the PhD. And this has another big change. He graduates and he moves to... There is an opening at UCAN. And there is opening for lecturers. There is a department being built. And so Ishtar is asked to participate in that. And he continues working in the statistical analysis of precipitation, the estimation of precipitation. But essentially, he puts a lot of energy in the building up of the department. And with the pedagogical methods learned at McGill, he was also teaching at UCAM students. And below, we see a bit of the different branches his research took. You see quantitative interpretation of radar data. He did early work with Doppler radar data and studied in drop size distribution. And the department continued growing, and here we have a nice team of professors, some gone. And he became at the time chairs of the physics department. And for the contribution to the building of this department, to the program in atmospheric sciences at UCAM, he won the Patterson Medal. At that time, too, you notice I mentioned only things related to observations. Now he also became interested in modeling of the rain processes. And then comes another big change in Ishtar's life, that is, he joins McGill. Now, all that energy he had put in building up the department at UCAN is now more concentrated in building up a group. And here we see in this picture three very distinguished members of that group of the first years. And during the time with this group, he spent some of his time with the ideas related with wind retrieval. Fred's going to talk about a bit about that, obviously. Precipitation forecasting, studies of the melting layer, and the installation of the bistatic and the development of the bistatic. For that, he won the President's Prize of the CMOS. Life continued, and the team grew bigger, and you, on the right, you see a picture of the roof of the Burnside Hall. You see a lot of stuff there. When I arrived there for the first time, and Ishtar took me there, he showed me all that, and there was, in addition, the radar in Santander View and the bistatic being installed, and he said that, I'm like a kid with too many toys, because really we were not that many students, and there were more than one radar per guy. But we had a lot of fun, because it was amazing the things you could do with so many instruments. I hope students came later had as much fun as we had. And so at the time, we were working with wind and thermodynamical retrieval from the bistatic, with relations between, estimating the relation between the observed precipitation and the measured reflectivity by the radar. And then an interesting thing was the simulation of a storm initialized by static data. Then came the last years, where many of the topics that he worked continued, drop size distribution, radar rainfall estimates, short-term forecasting that was particularly strengthened then, and scale dependence of precipitation properties. And during this period, there was another important thing happening. That is, he won important awards. He became a fellow of the MAS, Remote Sensing Prize AMS Award, a member of Academy of Science of Canada. So here ends the timeline of his career. Fred's going to talk much more in detail about the scientific aspects, but I would like to show one thing more. This is a little thing I did. I'm not sure if you, Ishtar, are going to agree with all what you see, but what I did is I divided your work in five categories, and I built this kind of histogram, bibliometric histogram. So you can see many things, but one thing that I saw was, for example, radar development, the color on the right below, the red one, you see, you seem to be less interested in that, while, for example, in precipitation and predictability issues of precipitation, you see your interest seems to be growing, and microphysics of precipitation seems to be a steady interest for the last 20 years. And to finish with my part, I would like to present something more related with bibliometrics, are the top collaborators with Ishtar. So we have Guwon Lee first, and very close, Wanda, then Fred, and then Stefan, all very close to each other. I'm not sure if you knew all that, but well. So, Fred.
So I want to talk a little bit about more Ishtar, the supervisor, and the colleague. So, of course, as scientists and as university people, we live in an environment of colleagues, of which some are presented here. Top picture is the radar 30th anniversary party with some of the many members of the department, students, staff, etc., and a few photos of colleagues below. I want to talk about Ishtar the dreamer. Ishtar has many faces, and one of them is Ishtar the dreamer. He has an amazing ability to be able to take these ideas coming from multiple places, put them together, show something new that you didn't see before, and smile and say, cute, hey? And generally followed by a small laugh, or preceded by a small laugh, actually. And I've actually been a privileged witness of many of these, what he called mental diarrhea. And I can say, honestly, that I've always been jealous or very impressed by them, even though the first thing I was trying to do was trying to poke at them and trying to find problems with them. I'm not the only one who's been experiencing these things with Ishtar. I contacted a few colleagues, and I got this email from Jim Wilson, who's an expert in short-term forecasting by radar. And he was saying the following. Ishtar was an inspiration to all. I will forget about Jim's accent. There's no way I can actually try to reproduce. We are probably most impressed by some of his great talks. He's one of those people that you know has it right. So when he talks, you listen to every word. And many colleagues have that kind of reactions. Other colleagues were touched by Ishtar in completely different ways. Oh, that's too bad. That didn't go. My sound bite didn't quite bite. So this is a comment from Alan Seed. I was very impressed by the way he sets up his lunch. He set his table for his lunch, and he was explaining how he deploys his napkin, put everything nicely in position, and then start eating his lunch. I hope the sound is going to work, because I have to present, as I said, Ishtar is a very colorful person, partly because of his Latin education and his Slavic heritage. So there's Ishtar, the happy dreamer, and a few of us have had to experience, most of his students, to some time, Ishtar the stern. Many of them, people who have been there, will remember it. And as an illustration of that, I've decided to do an exercise of style, not entirely fair, where I contrast two accounts. One is Ishtar's first dealings with Marshall, his supervisor, and also in parallel, Daniel Kaya, Nawaturana's first dealing with Ishtar, the supervisor.
Doncs les parts amb les altres realitzats, a l'époque où Ishtar était à l'UQAM, en 84 en fait, je commençais mon mémoire de maîtrise, tout frais gradué du bac, et tout le monde sait, tous les étudiants qui sont aux études avancées savent combien important il est de recevoir des mots d'encouragement au début pour se donner le courage de poursuivre cette aventure-là.
And the second meeting I had with Marshall was when he called me to his office to explain to me what he wanted me to do, which I already knew because Marcel had
thought. Alors après quelques semaines de travail pour un document ou un travail que je devais rendre à Ishtar, donc lui remet le document et j'attends les feedbacks sur le produit final.
I want you to do and draw something. Film come out.
Il se passe une journée, deux jours, trois jours, il se passe rien. Donc je m'aventure dans son bureau, j'ose franchir la porte et je lui demande. Et puis, alors, qu'est-ce qu'il y a
eu? So after three attempts like that, I was trying to be helpful. He said, you mean this? And because since I knew what it was. And then he looks at me,
and the thing was silent.
Here, they were going to have a simple and what you want to say is.
You see them in
and then this explosion.
La réponse fut, je suis tellement là, pour faire que je censure, je suis tellement en tabarnak que je veux même pas te parler.
You mean that you know all of what I want to say? You mean that you're not interested in what I have to say?
Mais, de toute façon, fort de ce réconfort, de cette amour, j'ai poursuivi avec une nouvelle énergie.
Comme tous les étudiants.
Comme tous les étudiants du temps. Et j'ai quand même réussi à passer au travers.
So I want to talk a little bit about Ishtar's signs, okay, because after all, we're supposed to be doing some of that tier two. But I'm presenting with the awards, not to show the awards, but actually to show what the awards were for. And it's interesting that if you read what the awards are for, they're always for something different. 91 is about the work he did at UQAM. 98 is about bistatic radar and wind retrieval, so it's hardware and wind retrieval. 2001, it's about research, it's about microphysics, and applications to weather prediction, and then quantitative precipitation estimation, quantitative precipitation forecast. They're all different things, and typically most people would do a career in each of those, and Ishtar's career has actually spanned a lot of these topics. And because the way Ishtar works, these topics talk to each other, and work in one typically inspire work in another. Now, I don't want to talk too much, I don't want to do it science-centric, I want to talk about Ishtar, the method, as a scientist. So after a careful analysis, I've sort of established four methods of Ishtar for doing work. The first one is what I call first send a scout, do a preliminary work, then forget about it for about 10 years, and come back to the topic. So I want to illustrate that with this. So this is 1980 work by classic by Jim Wilson that I mentioned before, and Ed Brandes. This is the current wisdom at the time of what the radar, what the problem with radar is, and it says basically radar sees the sum of the diameter to the six, rainfall is a volume flux, and the secret, therefore, to get rainfall from radar is to get the drop size distribution right. Now, the first work of Ishtar on that is 1984, and it's actually a very important paper that actually never made it, as far as I know, as a publication. It's always a conference presentation, where he analyzed said possible errors of radar and shows that the variability of drop size spectra, which is what people focused on, introduced one of many errors, but not the most severe at that, and that you only get a rainfall right by addressing the various sources of error in a painstaking and meticulous manner. And the fact is now we get a much better appreciation of what the problem is. This is what a radar measures, and the color illustrates some of the reflectivity we measure in the vertical cross-section. So you've got snow before, this bright layer is a melting layer, then it's rain. The radar measures the volume at a certain level that is a mixture of all kinds of things, and you want to estimate what's that. So you need to compensate for everything that happens between that level and what happens to the surface. You have to account for the bright band, etc. Then we have got all kinds of other problems, birds' interference, blockage, etc., 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 things that we now appreciate. So now people have a much better feeling as to what the problem is. Are we closer to getting rainfall right? The answer is probably not that close. Why is that? Well, it's that because, in one way, a lot of these problems are simple scientifically, and people know what the problems are, but trying to fix it is a challenge, not very worthy of a scientist, typically. And if you give it to an engineer, or someone who thinks of the problem in an engineer manner, it will fail, because there's so much variability between cases that if you get something right for one case, it will not. And people look for magic bullets, new methods for measuring rainfall, while the only bullet there really is the one that needs to be bitten. So starting from the mid-2000s, Ishtar started with the help of a great academic institution called the Postdoctoral Fellow to actually bite that bullet. And he started to work on error statistics of correction for the vertical profile of reflectivity, actually quantify that, look at theoretical limit of polarization measurements, spatial characteristics of these errors, how do they depend on averaging, on time, on space, and how are all these errors related to each other? Because those are important things when we're going to try to put these measurements into a numerical model. We need to know these errors and how they're related, etc. So this is an illustration. There was the work in 84, a bit of a pause. I'm a bit stretching. And then the main work a little bit later. Approach number two is what I would call the systematic sweep. So here again, I'm illustrating with a vertical profile of reflectivity, showing snow, melting, etc. And Ishtar's first work on looking at the microphysics of these processes starts, of course, at the bottom, because that's where we have the measurements of drop size distribution. And this shows plots of drop size distribution in light rain here at the bottom and in heavier rain above. And one of the things that they show is that these drop size distributions have a different, don't follow the nice exponential. They start to stack on top of each other. This was a measurement finding that was predicted by a list and others a few years earlier. The students of Ishtar will note that he hadn't converted to using big labels on his on his axis at the time. If you can read the axis. So he started to work and say, okay, what causes these drop size distribution? We understand. What causes the exponential drop size distribution? So he started to move up. And he looked at, with colleagues, the development of drop size distribution in light rain, looking at water processes, growth processes in warm rain, trying to see whether he could simulate this exponential distribution. Failed miserably, got, however, drop size distribution that looked very much like the one that you see in Hawaiian rain. So it told him, okay, well, that means I understand the Hawaiian rain, but the snow, anything that comes with the drop size distribution, have to come from higher. So after looking at the rain, he starts looking at the melting snow, systematically going up, and he's done a bunch of work on melting snow, some on measurements, some on modeling, much work in that. And after looking at melting snow, he's heading towards looking at snow, and this is all we're progressing. This is actually where you're just coming out, the first study of Ishtar with looking at snow microphysics. Now, I'm a great believer of the extrapolation forecast. So I'm going to make a forecast of Ishtar's next work based on this careful data analysis. And after having looked at the rain at the surface, rain, melting snow, he will have to look at nucleation, because he will find that a lot of secrets in the snow happen in the formation of the ice crystals. And I know that to be a fact, because you know how I mentioned that Ishtar generally does scout work before he does his main work? Well, the scout work has already been done, and it's the work that has been done by ice-forming nuclei by van der Schirmer and Zawadzki. The only thing I don't know, because I haven't computed the velocity of travel of his thinking, is when he will actually start that work. But Parisa, watch out, Ishtar's coming. Plan number three, don't neglect simple heuristic approaches. Ishtar has been working on trying to do forecast of rainfall, and one of the many methods he uses is echo tracking and extrapolation. Those techniques have been around for quite some time. I mean, Aldo Bellon here did his master PhD thesis both on that in the 70s. But they're always new thing that you can try, and they're very hard. These forecasts for very short times are actually very hard to beat. So instead of using a radar, use the radar networks and then add better extrapolation algorithms, smooth the unpredictable scales, try to blend it with numerical weather prediction, work in progress, trying to put diurnal cycle and get a product that can be used commercially called MAPLE, the McGill algorithm for prediction by Lagrangian extrapolation, that is now licensed and sold by a company in the U.S. And then approach number four, if at first it fails, try again. And as an example, I want to talk about the quest for a radar-based atmospheric analysis and prediction system. So how that works, as we know, is you use time sequence of incomplete data. Ishtar uses radar, but other people can use other, to infer the forces that are at play in the atmosphere, and from those forces you retrieve the parameters in the atmosphere that results in that evolution, and then you can initiate the weather forecast. The challenge in that, though, is that the devil is in the details, and making the economy of one of the many steps will lead to failure, and this has been learned the hard way. And perhaps many, many, many generations of students have been expanded on this quest. It started very simply by Daniel Cayet looking at linear wind, and then it started more boldly by Stéphane Laroche, who did the first attempts at retrievals and of conditions in the atmosphere. We saw this picture, Alain Caillat, Alain Prota working on this, trying to push the ideas more, making a little progress, and then we discover a little bit later that, yeah, okay, we had one case right, but there's things that we're missing. Okay, maybe the problem is not constrained well enough. Let's try having better radars. Try the bistatic. That didn't quite work. Try using the profiler to constrain the vertical motion. That didn't provide very much. Try more experimentation. And gradually, we're learning what the problems are, and more fresh blood is being put into this endeavor. And it's not, I mean, the problem is not simple. And the students here are truly marvelous students, really trying to do miracles. And they're trying to even illustrate that. This is a famous cartoon that Nishtha likes to show. But what the students who did the cartoon are trying to say, you're asking something that is very, very hard to do. It requires an equilibrium effort in order to try to get the apple. And, well, thank God you have there's your enthusiasm behind to encourage the student to continue, because I guess if it wasn't for that, a lot of the students would have given up a long time ago. Now, questions about what now, about Ishtar. I contacted a few colleagues around the world to have their thoughts about Ishtar's retirement and Ishtar's what he will do after. So I asked them, how concerned are you about Ishtar's retirement? And here are some of the reactions that I got.
Well, in some way, I think it will not happen like all of us think on retirement, no? He will be active for sure.
I mean, he can't retire, he's not gonna. If you retire, you die. You don't want to do that.
It'd be exciting to see what happens in the department with such a turnover all at once.
The thing is, you don't really retire. I retired physically in 1984, but I continued to hold have an office at Goddard, and believe it or not, I have a paper being published this year, which is my last one. By the rule of my wife.
So, Ishtar, you heard the man, Dominique Willing, to 25 more years. I'll drink to that. Thank you.
Tributes from the audience.
On behalf of the colleagues that work on the radar, I'd like to say how much we are indebted to Ishtar for rescuing the radar Yurikani from the Kabbalah who sort of fall to the cracks, and be the leaders for maybe 20 years and bring a lot of new research, new sensor tools, bring in capable students and postdocs from overseas. And also at the same time, securing a financial stability. I'd like to go back to fall 72. I just started my master thesis in May, and I was not going anywhere. And coming out of Burnside Hall in the afternoon, I met Ishtar and Peter Zwack. And I explained my problem, and they told me, try cross-correlation. So I did that, and it turned out to be a very great advice. Thank you very much.
Any other tributes? Well, Ishtar, I'd just like to express my sincere gratitude for your coming into our department and saving the radar and making this remote sensing facility into one of the world's great facilities. And I think it was pretty clear from these presentations that you've had enormous success with dealing with huge problems. And your students have been great, they're leaders, and it looks like you've got a lot of work to do ahead of you. So, at this point, I'd like to welcome an old friend to the department. Turns out he was my boss from 98 to 03, Dr. Charles Lynn, who's now the Director General at Environment Canada. And we're privileged to have him here with us today to say a few words.
Thanks, John. It's a great honor for me to be here. Most of you know that before going to Environment Canada, I was a member of the department. I was a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences from 1986 to 2006, so 20 years. A good part of my career was spent at McGill, and it feels a bit strange to be referred to as a guest when coming back to McGill. But so be it. This is how the timeline works in the human condition. So what I would like to present is really not science. I mean, that I think has been covered quite extensively by the talks of the preceding speakers. I would like to offer some personal reflections on these four gentlemen whom we are honoring today. To set the context, McGill University, for me, as I said, is a. I spent 20 years of my career here. I divide it into three stages: pre-McGill, before 1986; McGill, 86 to 2006; and then post-McGill. Now, 2007 to present. Now, it turns out that before coming to McGill, I had known all four gentlemen already, to different degrees, to be sure. I will start with Lawrence. And Lawrence has heard this story before. I recounted it at his 65th birthday celebration. He may or may not remember the details. I did my undergraduate studies at UBC, where Lawrence was a professor. I was in the physics and math department, but our paths never crossed. And he was in the math department. I took a fair number of courses in the math department, but I never was in any course that he taught. And then I went to MIT to do a doctorate in meteorology, and that was when our paths first crossed. It was in the late 70s, perhaps 1978, 77, a WAVE conference, an AMS WAVE conference in Boston. And at that time, Lawrence, as we heard from Gordon, was one of the authorities on ocean waves. And I was doing dynamic meteorology at MIT. So for some reason, I don't remember how we got put in touch. But as we all know, Lawrence is great at networking. I mean, whether young or old, whether it's a beginning graduate student or to a world-famous scientist, Lawrence is great at networking. So somehow we got in touch with each other. And so Lawrence suggested lunch, right? One of his favorite mode of interaction. So we had lunch at the hotel where the conference was held. I was a graduate student. Lawrence was a world authority on ocean waves. And, of course, no lunch with Lawrence is complete without wine. And Lawrence proceeds to order 1 liter of wine for the two of us. I said, wow, this is the middle of the day in a conference, and this is what professors do, right? And it was at that time that I decided to become a professor. So now Lawrence quibbles with me that it was actually half a liter, right, that he ordered. Now, I don't... He may have been right. I distinctly remember it was a pretty big carafe, right? It was 1 liter. But it's a telling sign that none of us can really remember whether it's half a liter or 1 liter. So needless to say, I didn't get very much work done for the rest of the day. So that's Lawrence in the pre-McGill era. Now, Ishtar, I didn't know professionally, but going through some of my old papers, I actually, when I finished at MIT, I actually applied for a job at UCAM. And I wrote to Ishtar applying for a job. Even I had forgotten about that until I dug up the old correspondence and saw this carbon. In those days, there were no photocopies of this carbon, copy. And UCAM had been wanting to recruit a dynamicist, so I applied to UCAM. Now, Henry, the pre-McGill days, Henry was the editor of Atmosphere Ocean, Atmosphere at that time, and I believe I submitted a paper and Henry was the editor. So that was my interaction with Henry. And Jacques, now, again, through professional concerns, professional interaction, I was working on instability of non-zonal states, and Jacques had been working in that area. And one of the papers that that Gilbert showed, or at least one of the names that Gilbert showed, Kirkwood, wrote a paper with Jacques, Kirkwood and Derome, which I read very carefully. So I had already known Jacques' work, and I had studied his contributions to this area quite intensively before coming to McGill. Now, McGill, of course, I will talk about for the rest of this talk. Now, post-McGill 2007, I'm with Environment Canada now, but I continue to have professional interactions with my colleagues here. Several big files that are happening now, the Canadian Foundation for Climate and Atmospheric Science. Lawrence is a member of the board, and Jacques had been a member of the board before. Our minister visited the board a little while ago, and, of course, we have to prepare the briefing notes and explain and brief the minister on these issues. Another issue that I interact with these colleagues is through the Uranos Consortium. I sit on the board of Uranos. Jacques is the chair of the science committee of Uranos, so we have had discussion there. So that's post McGill. Now back to the McGill era. Work, all right, and then I'll talk about play. Now for work, university academic types are judged on three criteria: right? Research, teaching, and administration. And the standard line is that unless you're a professional administrator, it's 40% research, 40% teaching, and 20% administration. So tenure, promotion, merit pay, and that sort of stuff is judged on this. And by the way, I was chair of the department from 1998 to 2003. And as we heard, Jacques did two terms of chair, and Henry did one term, and now John is into his second term. So I'm the only chair who is not the current chair or one of the people being honored. So John cannot obviously say too much about too much embarrassing details, right? Because he's still the current chair. And Henry and Jacques cannot say anything, right? Because they are among the honored people. However, I'm no longer at McGill, and I can say these things. Right? So, work. Research, well, we've all heard about the research contributions of our distinguished professors, so I'm not going to elaborate on that. Teaching. Now, a duty of a chair is to assign teaching duties. Right? And at the beginning of the year, at the end of the academic year, you do that, and you look at the courses that need to be taught, and you look at the people who are available, and then you try to do the best you can. And one of the challenges of assigning teaching is who is going to teach these big first-year courses. Right? We have two of them, or at least we had two of them when I was still here: Introduction to Atmospheric Science, Introduction to Oceanic Sciences. They're offered twice a year, one term each year, so you really need four bodies to teach. And these courses typically have enrollment ranging from 80 to 150 and above. And recently there have been other big courses such as, Storms? Signs of Storms, and there could be others. But when I was chair, there were these four courses. And throughout the years, Lawrence had done many years of teaching of 220, Introduction to Ocean Sciences, and Henry had taught 210 for many years. And even Ishtar, right, who finds creative ways to avoid teaching. So this is the kind of things I can say, right, as no longer a member of McGill, and yet who has been chair and known some of the behind the scenes aspects. Ishtar finds creative ways of to avoid teaching, you know, such as hiring others and so on and so forth. Even Ishtar has taught first year courses, right? 215, is that correct? 214, 215. Now Jacques is not here anymore, but he went home because of he needed rest from the operation that he had. The only one, as far as I know, who has not taught a first-year course is Jacques. He has not taught 214, 215, 210, 220, and Science of Storms. Right. So, if Jacques, John, this is advice to you. Right? If Jacques comes back to you and says, John, can you arrange for some part-time work for me? You will give him two terms of 210. Right. Okay. Administration. Administration, well, we've had two chairs of the department, Henry and Jacques, and we also have had two directors of centers, the climate center that Lawrence headed, founded, and the Marshall Observatory that Marshall founded and Ishtar revived. And so these two, all four individuals have made significant contributions to the administrative aspect. Play. Now, you notice this list is much longer than work. Okay, so I'll go through it one by one. Lunch. Right. We, the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, sometimes it seems is almost solely responsible for keeping the faculty club going. Right. For years, at least 15 years, right, Lawrence, Jacques, and I would eat at the club like three times a week. And Henry would join occasionally, and Ishtar, until Dominique put him on some kind of diet, right, where he had to take this napkin and fold it and sell it, this whole thing up. Right, Ishtar would come as well. So there used to be four, and then we dwindled to three, and I'm not sure what's happening now. Right. But we had lunch three times a week, right, at the cafeteria downstairs. And before that, it was in this ballroom where Lawrence and Jacques and I ate. And there would be, well, we would sit here, and that the table over the corner there was for the dean, right, or the VP. I don't remember now. But anyway, so that's a bit of history. Dinner, right? The four of us have socialized over the last two decades. Our wives know each other. We have been to each other's place many times, sometimes all together, sometimes with other groups. And this, I must say, is a real extension to the professional wife, to the professional life. that is a Freudian slip. That was not designed. Right? So many, many dinners together with lots of interesting talk, lots of wine and beer. Drinking. Right? I believe I'm the founding member of the Friday beer club at the faculty club. Right? Almost when I was here, almost every Friday, I would knock on the door of Lawrence. His office is right next to me. And I said, Lawrence, interested in beer? And Lawrence would almost always say yes. Then I would go to Jacques, and Jacques would say, give me 2 minutes. Then he calls Monique, right? And then there's a silence of about a couple of minutes. And then Jacques, yes, okay. So then Jacques would come. And then Henry would come occasionally, but he would tell me, I have to catch an express bus, right, at 5:35 or whatever it is. So I only have about 15 minutes. So he finishes beer in about 15 minutes and then goes and catches express bus. And Ishtar would come every now and then. But certainly we had many happy hours after work. Occasionally we would play pool upstairs in the bar room. Now, all four members own cottages, right? They not only own houses, they own cottages. And we've been invited to all four of these cottages. I remember Ishtar's farm where when we went, I believe you had your tractor stolen or something like that, right? And so that was a bit of a story. And Lawrence has his swimming pool, and so we had many We had many good conversations there, and Henry has a place as well, and Jacques rented. When we went there, it was a rental place, which I believe you subsequently bought. Bridge. Right. Now, Henry and Lawrence are keen bridge players. Right. And again, we've had many games over the last decade or so. For me personally, it was with Lawrence and other friends. Occasionally, we would play with Henry as well. Now, for many years, whenever Lawrence's dad came, and many of you know his dad through the scholarship that Lawrence and McGill endowed. Lawrence's dad is a very good bridge player and a very keen bridge player. And when we first started out about 20 years ago, Lawrence was an okay player, but not very good. Right? You don't have to be a chair to be able to say these things, but anyway. But throughout the years, Lawrence's play improved significantly. And I think at first he was a little bit intimidated by his father. First of all, bridge can be a little bit intimidating in the sense that it's a very complicated game. And playing with your dad, who's a very good player, can be intimidating as well. But Lawrence has now evolved to a very good bridge player. And unfortunately, because of my change in jobs and my travel schedule, that part of my life has taken a bit of a hit. That is one aspect that I really miss. The last time I played with Lawrence was probably 6 months ago, right? And whereas before it was more like 3 weeks, two, 3 weeks. Every two, 3 weeks we would have a game. Now, in our younger days, Lawrence and I played squash, and Henry and I played squash. But as you know, squash is a very exacting game with lots of stop-and-go movements, so our bodies couldn't really take it. And I want to relate one incident playing with Henry. Now, we all know that Henry is a gentleman and a scholar, even on the squash court. Right? Squash is a very aggressive game, those of you who know it. Right? It's for type A people. Right? You're in this confined court with no windows. It's a box with this ball whizzing past at high velocity. And I inadvertently, my racket hit Henry. And, of course, it hurt, right? Because you're jostling for position, and it hurt. And Henry, not only did he not complain, he said, "Do you want the point?" Right? So Henry even volunteered to give me the point because as the racket hit him, he couldn't retrieve the ball. I don't know if you remember that, but that is actually a true story. Now, as our squash days became fewer and far between, we moved into tennis. And for years, Henry and I played once a week, twice a week, summer and winter. And then Henry, I believe, got injured, and then unfortunately the game stopped. And I also played a few games with Lawrence as well. Now, finally, music. Lawrence already mentioned, or Gordon already mentioned, Lawrence's interest in music, and I believe Fred also mentioned Ishtar's interest in music. My wife, Janet, is a piano teacher. She's back there. And she has organized concerts at our place given by her students. And one of these students was called Gary, was taking an advanced exam. This is about 7-8 years ago. And he had a 1 hour, as part of the requirement for this exam, he had to have a 1 hour repertoire of different pieces prepared and ready to go. So as a dry run, Janet arranged a concert at our place. And he invited all these four gentlemen. Now, Lawrence couldn't come because he was out of town at that time. But Ishtar, Jacques, and Henry all came, and I believe with their wives as well. It was a very enjoyable concert, and this interest in participation in music continues. We still go to concerts together and we continue that dimension. Now, that's play. Now, you know that sometimes you get asked, right? Use one word to describe an object or a person. Right? So I'm going to use one word to describe these four individuals. And I'm not going to use words like excellence or training or students or right, which have all been covered. For Lawrence, I mentioned that he is great at making new friends, reinforcing existing friendships. So for Lawrence, the word is networking. Okay. For Jacques and Henry, it's the same word. And whenever I talk to Jacques and Henry, I get a very balanced approach, a very balanced and reasoned argument as to why what we should do this or we should not do that. So the word for Jacques and Henry is équilibré. Right? Now, for Ishtar, if you go into his office and talk about administration, he'll just roll his eyes, right? And he'll just say, why are we doing this, right? If you talk about music, then he'll listen. But his great passion is science. So for Ishtar, it's science. One word that applies to all four of them that I will now show is all four of them have considerable wisdom. So they are all wise. And I have been the beneficiary of this wisdom first as a young faculty member at McGill and then as a regular professor and then as chair of the department. Right? As chair, you cannot do everything alone. You are really only as effective as what your colleagues and your faculty and staff allow you to be. And this is true everywhere, right? In not just universities, in the government, in my current job as well. And I've benefited greatly from the wisdom of these four people. And to show that, to summarize this wise counsel that I have received over the years, I'm going to show a proverb. Now, this proverb has been attributed to various sources. And just judging by a statistical sample of going on to Google and tracking, right, which this proverb is attributed to, this the finding is that this proverb seems to have come from a Persian source. It has also been attributed to Confucius. Right, so it's really not very clear. But doesn't matter. It's the substance here. He who knows not and knows not he knows not is a fool. Shun him. He who knows not and knows he knows not is simple. Teach him. Now, another version of this is asleep, and then you would wake him. Okay? Same idea. Well, no, sorry, it's this one. He who knows and knows not he knows is asleep. Wake him. And then I think we can all recognize ourselves in some of these aspects. And then the final one is the one that applies to our four honorees. He who knows and knows he knows is wise. Follow him. So as I said, I have been the beneficiary of the wisdom of these four individuals. The department has been the beneficiary of the wisdom and counsel of these four individuals, and so has McGill University. I will close by looking forward a little bit. Right. They will retire by the end of this month. Of course, this does not mean that they will drop out of science. Likely, they will do other things, such as enjoying weather and climate, as John, was it John, you said that? Rather than predicting weather and climate to... No, you said that. Gilbert said that. To enjoy weather and climate, be it in their cottages or in their homes, looking after or playing with their grandchildren or whatever. Right? I'm going to... So this is certainly not the end. Right? And borrowing the words of a politician who had some influence in the Second World War, this is certainly not the beginning of the end, but it is the end of a beginning. This beginning is, to be sure, a long phase of their association with McGill. As they retire, they move into another phase where I'm sure there may be some science, but there will be other dimensions that will occupy their time and their lives. So I want to thank each of you, Henry, Ishtar, Lawrence, and Jacques, personally, for the contributions that you have made to the department, to McGill University, and I thank you for making space and room for me to share in this journey that you have partaken at McGill University. Thank you.
Okay, well, the clock is ticking, and I would like to briefly give a few presentations, to each of our honorees, and to honor them properly. You'll notice that there are four bags up here, and I will read the name off presently. Ishtar, could you please come up? I'd like to remind all of our honorees today that this is a work day. Tomorrow's a work day. Monday is a holiday, but you still have your obligations through May 31st. And I also like to remind you that your new appointments begin on June 1st as emeritus professors. You'll have space and all the opportunities afforded you as an emeritus professor to conduct all the research that you wish to. And to keep track of time, I think you'll find that there's something here that will allow you to do so. Thank you, Ishtar. So I'd like to ask Monique to please come up and accept our departmental gratitude to Jacques. Please give him our best and to and Henry. Must be Lawrence. I didn't even look. Thank you so much, Lawrence.
Okay,
So Charles mentioned the duties of the chair and so forth, and certainly there are many, many times that I, as chair, feel very much alone in my responsibilities. But at the same time, he's right. In order to get anything done, you need the support of your colleagues, and you also need the support of your staff. And this would not have happened today had it not been for the tremendous support that has been provided to me by Ornella. Ornella, wave to us, please. Anna? Still there, Anna Sarong? Okay. And where is Michael? Michael Havas has been tremendous in the support of the department. And finally, where is Rebecca? She's left the building. So I really appreciate your help and support. This has really gone on very well, and we deeply appreciate everything that you've done for us. Okay, so I got an email, actually, from Henry asking whether there was time on the schedule for words from the honorees, and I said no, because it's not on the program, because the program had already been printed, but he'll take it anyway.
No, there's a lot I could say. This has been a very moving day, I think, for all of us, and I'm not going to say, there's not time for me to say the things, all the things I would like to say. But what I do want to say is, on behalf of all four of us, I want to thank John. I think this is an event that none of us anticipated. We appreciate it immensely. It was it's something that we're all going to remember, and we thank you and the department for doing this for us.
So, interestingly enough, I don't want to belabor any points here, and I'd like to get on to the reception, but Charles mentioned the fact that he was at MIT, and we were both students at the same time there. And I think it's important to try to understand what life was like at MIT in those days. I think you were on the 15th floor, is that right, of Green, or the 14th? And I was on the 16th. And generally speaking, the department was so stratified that rarely did we see each other. Rarely did groups interact and so forth. And I think one of the great aspects of our department here at McGill is collegiality and the fact that, yeah, we have three floors, 7, 8, and 9, but we regularly transport ourselves among the various floors and actually see people and talk to people and interact with both colleagues and students. And I think that's one of the aspects that really has contributed to our department's excellence. See, we don't even remember each other's floor. Yeah, well, I was there a little later, so I'm younger than you guys, so it's fine. But the important point is that the four people that we're honoring here today have really contributed very substantially to our departmental collegiality and have produced, if you will, a mixed layer among the floors, 7, 8, and 9. The stratification at MIT was substantially different, and we really are grateful for all of your service. So just a reminder, we have a reception that is planned. There will be musical accompaniment during that reception. And I wish you all the best, and have a great evening. Thank you.